Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Sue Leaf joins us again this morning. She's written a raft of wonderful books about Minnesota and environmental and historical issues. Her new book is called Minnesota's Geologist, The Life of Newton Horace Winchell, and there's going to be a virtual event tonight via Zenith Bookstore, and the event is co-sponsored by Café Scientifique in the Twin Ports. We'll have details on that coming up in just a little bit. Sue, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for asking me.
So you had a virtual launch event earlier this week in conjunction with the Minnesota Historical Society Press, or the University of Minnesota Press and the Bell Museum. Tell me what it's like. You're a prolific author. Tell me what it's like to do these virtual events as opposed to, you know, maybe a real life event where you have to sit and stare at a room full of people and answer their questions and maybe read from the book. What's the virtual? How does the virtual event compare?
Well, a real life launch, you get to sit and stare at real people. With a virtual one, you have to tell stories to a screen, which is much more difficult. We had a rehearsal so I could figure out how to get my slides up on the screen. And I realized very quickly that it was not going to be like any other book launch, that I was going to have to, well, I was told I should write out a script and hew to the script. And then I had to tell stories. My husband said, it's too terse. You really need to tell some stories. And that was hard, too. So I wrote out the stories and then pretended I was seeing faces before me.
Now, when we do, I got to ask you about this just a little because I'm curious. When we do, you know, Zoom meetings, we can see the other people in the group. But when you do a virtual thing like this, you don't really get to see all your audience members. You don't get to look in their little screeny faces.
The launch was a webinar, and I'm not sure of the difference, but I could see the moderator from the Bell Museum and Harvey Thorlefson, the MC for the event, and that was it. Unfortunately, I couldn't see faces of people who were there, and I was told that at one point we had 179 people, which I think was maybe three times more than I would have drawn at a normal launch. And I know I got people, my girlfriends from the East Coast and the West Coast. I don't think probably I'll ever go back to an in-person launch again. It was very successful.
Well, that is true. Now all they have to do is figure out a way so that you can see everybody's faces, even if they take turns or something, and then you'll be set. Because I imagine, especially when you're telling stories, that magical kismet between you and the audience is part of what makes it really work.
Right. You need to know if you're connecting. You need to look at their eyes and see if their eyes are lighting up. At something you're saying that they can connect to? Right. I'm hoping with Zenith tonight that I can see the faces.
I'm going to have to log in and I'll hold up a sign. I did the interview this morning.
Okay. But yes, that'd be great.
That really, you know, if you can do that, that really is the magic of some of these things, because people who do live in other parts of the world or even just who can't drop things and go physically at that time are able to maybe join in, you know, from the living room or from the laptop or whatever, a corner of the kitchen. And what a great thing. That's just magical. Let's talk about your topic just a little bit. I would imagine that unless you are and I've got some friends who are, one of those people that are really interested in rocks or agates or gemstones or fill in the blank, that drumming up people's attention about minerals, about rocks, could be a little bit more challenging. Rocks don't have the cute factor. They're not really fluffy. They're not fabulous conversationalists. We know they make good pets. But were you surprised as you began your research into the life of this man to find it kind of take off? What was the spark that made you go, wow?
I shied away from this topic for a year or more because I don't have a good geology background. I had had one geology course in college, and I had had a year of paleontology in graduate work. But I've always been interested in landforms, and this guy was so pivotal to natural history education in Minnesota in the 1870s that I thought really something more should be. He shouldn't be lost to history. And so I thought, and who better to do this than me? And so when I approached my editor about the topic, he said, well, don't worry about your geological knowledge. We'll get you a geologist to read your work and make sure that you are doing everything truthfully.
Right. And if there's any of those little errors that the experts would catch and say, not quite right. Wrong word. This is a better one. That kind of thing. Okay.
And my writing group kept me in line. I found out quickly that a writing group that was highly educated wasn't necessarily highly educated about rocks. And in fact, one of my touchstones was one of my writing friends that has 3 master's degrees and spoke 4 languages said, "What is an igneous rock?" And I thought, okay, then, let's start at the very beginning. And I found out as I was writing out the chapters, I laid out the fundamentals of geology. You know, how do geologists look at the world? What kinds of things are they using to assess what they're seeing? And it was part of that was the history of geology. And geology is not that old of a science, so it was pretty easy to go back to the very beginnings of the true science and make that clear to the reader. So I hope that people come away with a good, solid geological understanding when they read the book.
So you had to lay some groundwork for people. You had to lay a little bit of groundwork for people at the beginning so that they could kind of get a sense of where everything is coming from and some of the terms and things that were going to be used. But then talk about the man himself and what it was. I mean, what a magical time to be living when you kind of had this frontier of knowledge to write about and explore, and no one had done it before you. It was kind of up to you to lay it all out for people. Talk a little bit about him and what you discovered about him.
Well, that's part of it, is that he was so much more than a dry scientist. He was an early feminist, and he was attracted to educated, brainy women, and married one, a college professor, in 1860. So you can imagine a woman with a college degree who was teaching in college in 1860. Okay, so she became one of the first women to be elected to public office in Minnesota. So there was that aspect. And then he had a brood of brilliant young children who all went to the University of Minnesota at one time or the other and are still well-known among certain circles today for their brilliance and their eccentricities. As you can imagine, a woman who was an early feminist would produce feminist children, and her 3 daughters were noteworthy at the university for their feminist activities in the 1890s and 1880s, and his sons all became prominent geologists in their own right. But he was also more than that. He was interested in history. He was a practicing Methodist, and he had a beautiful voice, so he sang in the church choir. And was the church historian. So that was interesting to me. And he himself had a bunch of siblings that were all interesting characters and that make it into the book. One of them was a prominent professor at the University of Michigan and was his mentor, Newton's mentor, for most of Newton's life.
Really?
So it was just, there was a connection to the University of Michigan. There was the university connection to the University of Wisconsin because his second son became a beloved professor there. There was a connection to Northwestern University north of Chicago because one of his son-in-laws became a professor of geology there. So there was just this wide cast of characters and this brilliance, sparkling intellect that I just wanted to bring to light.
It's interesting that so many of his children followed him into the field. It's not, I suppose, unusual for kids to want to do what their folks do, but obviously he made it appealing to his children in such a way that they didn't say, oh, this is the last thing I want to do. He must have made it feel exciting and fun and like this would be a great thing to be if many of his kids went on to be also become geologists.
Right, and how did he do this? Well, for the oldest one, he took the oldest one in the field when the oldest one was like 10. They were driving a horse and a wagon down in southeastern Minnesota. And I think in part this oldest child was smart, really smart, and kind of a handful. And there were three other children at home at the time. And so I think Winchell took this oldest one along. And this oldest one, by the way, becomes a mining expert on the Mesabi Range. So he does have a northeastern Minnesota strong connection. It took him along to get him out of his mother's hair. So he got exposed very early to science and to rocks. And the second child, I think by that time, they had their uncle at the University of Michigan, who was also a geologist. And I think geology was just kind of settling in to be the family trade. And this one, the second child, his son also became a prominent geologist at Yale. And there is a textbook that is optical mineralogy that's still in use today that Winchell and his son, the professor at Wisconsin, authored, and then the one at Wisconsin subsequently authored it with his son at Yale. So there's a lot of family interaction.
That is what a wonderful family legacy. And again, I mean, everybody can think about a parent that was so crabby about, you know, I know some people that were turned off fishing for life because their dads were such tyrants when it came to fishing. You have to be quiet and you
like
can't.
My husband. Yep.
But whatever his approach in imparting his discipline to his kids, he must not have taken that approach because so many of them found it fascinating and he must have given them a lot of fun and some leeway to explore that they went on to create this geologist dynasty, kind of.
Well, I think two other things. Winchell, compared to most fathers of the 19th century, Winchell was a very hands-on father. He's very nurturing. When the kids were sick, he was one of the chief nurses. He and his wife shared that responsibility. So he was a present parent to his kids. And then also he was a teacher. He started out life as a teacher at 15, and he was very careful. He was very interested in instructing people, whether they were his students at the University of Minnesota or the Board of Regents, who was reading his annual report, or his children or the people surrounding him. And so he knew how to teach. He knew how to make a subject lively. Can we talk about Winchell's experience with Duluth?
Let's do that briefly, and then I want to make sure that we get the information again about your event this evening. And if folks have additional questions, let's hope they'll be able to ask them of you at the virtual event. Talk about his experience in Duluth.
Well, I think I'll just talk about his first camp. In 1878, Duluth was his jumping-off point for his summer spent sailing along the North Shore looking at the rock formations there. And they camped at Chester Creek, at the mouth of Chester Creek, which is beyond the city limits at that point. This city limits is kind of a grand term for a town that was pretty small and that had been hit hard by the panic of 1873. And so they went into town and they got their equipment, which is included like a pick and the pails. And he had a crew with him, one that knew how to cook bread over an open fire that they were really thrilled with. And they went fishing and caught whitefish to eat. And then they took off from there. They didn't get very far. They only got as far as the Lister River because of the winds. And they ended up going eventually to Agate Bay, which was not a town that became two harbors. And they went to Beaver Bay, which is where they picked up mail. There was Ojibwe from Grand Portage who was also delivering mail so that they would look for this guy. His name was Chief Bear Grease.
Oh, that guy.
John Bear Grease's dad. And they would entertain him at their camp whenever, because he had the mail, which is what they wanted. whenever they got a sight, caught sight of him. So they'll have, people have to read a book, but I did devote two chapters to the North Shore.
Oh, that is wonderful. We will get the information up about the virtual event this evening. That is happening courtesy of zenithbookstore.com. They've got all of the details. The event is being co-sponsored by Café Scientifique in the Twin Ports, which has been bringing just some fabulous programming to this area. And as I mentioned, we'll get the details up on the website, so it'll be easy for folks to find. Sue, thank you so much for joining us this morning. What a treat.
It was my pleasure. Enjoyed talking with you.
Sue Leaf is the author of a new book called Minnesota's Geologist, The Life of Newton Horace Winchell, and it's published by the University of Minnesota Press. Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.